Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
Who's in charge at your house? If you share that house with children, you signed up for spending a lot of your time, money, and energy to raise them. It's the deal we make as parents. What our kids are not entitled to is a vote in a lot of daily decisions, like what to eat, when to go to bed, and whether to pitch in around the house. These days, many parents cede control to their children on a lot of big decisions, and many kids are happy to grab the reins. But it turns out giving in might be the worst thing we can do for them. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest for the hour is family physician and psychologist Dr. Leonard Sachs. He's seen a decline in the well-being of children and their families that he links directly to the abdication of parental authority. And he writes about that in his new book, The Collapse of Parenting, How We Hurt Our Kids When We Treat Them Like Grown-Ups. Leonard, welcome back to Think.
Thanks for inviting me.
American children used to be, first of all, happier than their global peers. What has changed?
Well, the data are really striking on this regard. On so many parameters, the rates of anxiety and depression, the physical fitness, the weight of American kids. We used to be doing pretty good 20 to 30 years ago. Academic achievement 30 years ago, American kids led the world. But in a short period of time, and really over the last 15 years, it's become precipitous. The drop in the achievement of American kids relative to kids in other countries academically, the explosion in psychiatric diagnoses. A kid in the United States is now 14 times more likely than a kid in the UK to be on medications for ADD, 40 times more likely than a kid in Germany to be diagnosed and treated for bipolar disorder. 30 years ago, there wasn't a big difference between kids in the United States and kids elsewhere in the diagnosis of psychiatric disorders, but now we've seen an explosion.
Why would the change be more pronounced in the United States than in other Western industrialized countries that at least economically are comparable?
Well, some aspects of what I call the collapse of parenting are pretty common across the industrialized world. I was talking with Dr. Wright, who's the head of school at an independent school in Sydney, Australia. And he was telling me how a mother of one of his students contacted him and asked him, would he please meet with her son to counsel her son on the appropriate use of video games? And he said, no, I won't do that. He said, the job of governing and guiding your son's use of video games is not the job of the head of school. It's the job of the parent. So one aspect of what I call the collapse of parenting, namely the confusion many parents have about what their role is and what guidance they should give their kids, that's now become common across the world. But there are a few things that are specific to the United States. One of them is the culture, what I call the culture of disrespect. That is the notion that it's cute to be disrespectful to adults, disrespectful to one another. You know, in the United States, it's common to find kids wearing T-shirts that say things like, I'm not shy, I just don't like you. You don't find those T-shirts in Scotland or Switzerland or Australia or New Zealand. Well, you occasionally see them. But when you occasionally see them, you go up to that kid, as I have done. It turns out that kid is an American, an American tourist. In New Zealand, they don't find – kids don't think it's funny to say to someone else, I'm not shy, I just don't like you. But this universal disrespect, disrespect for adults, disrespect for one another, that's a – particularly American phenomenon.
There's a lot of entertainment content today designed specifically for children, which I think many parents like, knowing that, you know, they let their kids watch something on the Disney Channel or Nickelodeon. They know that their kids won't see violence or hear foul language or nudity. But you note that the programming tends to leave adult authority figures out completely. Parents are either the butt of the joke or they're just entirely absent.
Yeah, and you mentioned the Disney Channel, and it's especially bad on the Disney Channel. So Dog with a Blog, which is a very popular Disney show, the father is supposedly a school psychologist, but he knows nothing about children. The dog is consistently more insightful than the dad, which is supposedly, again, the funny thing. You're supposed to laugh at the father for being so clueless. Liv and Maddie, another Disney Channel show, the mom, another school psychologist who knows nothing about kids. Her two daughters mock her and roll their eyes because she's absolutely clueless and disengaged. Jessie, another Disney Channel show, the parents are absent altogether, and the ditzy nanny and the butler are utterly clueless. And this is the Disney Channel, as you said, supposedly a family-friendly show. But every show that is on the Disney Channel, and I can't think of an exception, undermines the authority of parents, portrays parents as irrelevant, clueless, pathetic.
What's remarkable about all this, Leonard, is that today's parents are investing, I think it's fair to say, in many families, investing more time, more energy, more money raising their children than any generation of parents before them. Parents want to get it right. So what are we all getting so wrong?
Well, you're absolutely right about that time, because I really looked into that carefully in writing the book. And an American father now spends three times as much time with his child or children today compared with 30 years ago.
Were they better off without us?
Well, spending more time with your kids doesn't accomplish a lot if you're not parenting right, if you don't understand what your role is. And I see so many parents in the office. I'm a practicing family physician, and it's really sad. A kid comes in with a fever and sore throat, six-year-old, and I look at the ears, which are fine. Then I say, okay, now I'm going to look at your throat. And before I have a chance to approach the child, mom says, is it okay if the doctor looks in your throat? And the daughter looks at her mom and thinks about it and says, no, I don't think so. She hears a bona fide question, and her answer is no. Well, mom's trying to be kind and in this 21st century sort of way, but the result is that this child now has to be restrained, and what should have been a 10-second procedure becomes a 5-minute ordeal requiring an assistant to hold the child so that I can force a strep test by force. And now the child feels like she's the wronged party because her parent asked her a question and she gave an answer and her answer was disregarded. In many domains of life, the child does not and should not get a choice. If you have a fever and a sore throat and you're at the doctor's office, you're going to get a strep test. It's not up to you. But these parents are ingrained in these habits. They cannot speak to their child in a sentence that ends with a period. Every sentence is a question. Is it okay with you if? Don't you think maybe we should leave now? And they're begging, they're pleading, they're bribing, and it hugely undermines the parent's authority. And if that's the kind of parenting you're doing, spending more time doing it is not going to accomplish anything good. You have to do it differently.
You suggest that parents command their children to do things, not necessarily unkindly, but command them to either do them or not do them rather than negotiate. How did today's generation of parents get so hung up on trying to rationalize every decision to their children?
Yeah, why did this happen? I've thought a lot about that. I've asked a lot of people. I've asked researchers. I've asked other parents and school principals and teachers, especially people in my age group who've been adults for 30 years, and we've seen it happen. I mean, so many parents, so many teachers, so many people over 50 will talk about how 30 years ago it was unthinkable for a child to say shut up to a parent in a public setting. Now it happens. I see it every day in the office. A 10-year-old will say shut up to their parents and think it's funny and think it's cute because that's the culture in which they live, the culture of disrespect. Why did it happen is your question. I think part of it is that political sensibilities infiltrated the household. So the second half of the 20th century was all about empowerment, and that's a good thing. Women gained equal rights relative to men, and that's a good thing. People of color gained equal rights relative to white people, and that's a good thing. But in that process, the notion of hierarchy and authority became suspect, came to seem old-fashioned, came to seem politically incorrect. And a parent 30 years ago might have said, why do you have to eat your broccoli before you have dessert? Because I'm your mom. That's why. But today, many parents are very uncomfortable saying that, and instead they turn it into a negotiation. Well, if you have three bites of broccoli, then you can have ice cream.
Hmm. So the authority within many families belongs today to children in a range of areas, including things like, you know, what to eat. Some parents might see this as like, I'm picking my battles, right? I'm gonna save the real arguments and the things that I want to stick to for the things that really matter. But beyond the concern about proper nutrition, which matters a lot, why is it a problem to leave that kind of decision up to children? To say, for example, what do you want to eat tonight? What are we buying ourselves when we offer them this option?
Well, I think it's fine to offer kids choices as long as the choices are constrained by the grown-up. So I think it's reasonable to say, hey, for the vegetable tonight, would you rather have broccoli or lima beans? I think that's perfectly reasonable to offer the child that choice. But I find many parents, including affluent, well-educated parents, who ask their kids, what do you want for supper this evening? And the kid wants pizza and french fries, and that's what they get. I was at an independent school that serves a very affluent clientele, and the principal had asked me to sit in the classrooms, and I did that, and I reported back to the principal, and I said, you know, your policy is not being enforced, I told the principal. You've got a policy, no personal use of cell phones during class time, but half the kids have their cell phone out, and they're texting anybody. And the principal said, yeah, I know. He said, but we tried to enforce a policy. We got tremendous pushback from the parents. One mom contacted the principal and said, look, I've got to be able to text my daughter and ask her what she wants for supper because I don't want to risk making something. You know, I made that eggplant and she refused it and we had to order pizza. So I have to be able to text my daughter and make sure she's okay with what I'm preparing. And the principal was like, are you kidding? You're the grown-up. You don't need your 12-year-old's permission to make supper. But many parents feel that they do.
Let me ask you this. When you're wearing your MD hat and a parent comes in with a child who is misbehaving, likely because the parents have set up dynamics that sort of lead to that behavior, if they haven't asked you for advice, do you bring it up or how do you broach the subject of like you're headed down a troublesome path here?
If they haven't asked me for advice, I don't bring it up. And I've learned the hard way. I used to. And, you know, nowadays we live in an age of instant feedback and everyone's worried about how they're being rated. And if you give that feedback without being asked, you're going to get some very negative ratings when people Google your practice. And they'll say, this doctor, I came in with my child, had a sore throat, and this doctor started lecturing me about what a bad parent I was. So I don't go there. If the parent didn't come in to consult with me about that issue, if they're there for a sore throat or an ankle sprain, that's what we focus on.
When they do come in for advice on parenting, do you find that parents almost just want your permission to be a little tougher with their kids, or do they argue back with
Yes.
you about why they can't do it?
No. Parents who come in to consult with me are usually parents who've read something I wrote for the New York Times or Wall Street Journal or read one of my books, and they are already, you know, 90% on board, and they just need a little. They want me to see their child very often and give them some guidance about this particular child and what he or she is doing. And that's great. But the parents who come to see me are already pretty much in agreement with the main thrust of what I have to say.
We're speaking this hour with family physician and psychologist Dr. Leonard Sachs. His new book is called The Collapse of Parenting, How We Hurt Our Kids When We Treat Them Like Grown-Ups. You can be part of the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with psychologist and family physician Dr. Leonard Sachs. His newest book is called The Collapse of Parenting, How We Hurt Our Kids When We Treat Them Like Grown-Ups. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Leonard, we know that young people have always sought peer approval, right? You and I did it when we were kids. What tells you, though, that today's kids seek it instead of parental approval rather than in addition to parental approval?
Yeah. This is where it's so important to look at the data, because otherwise, you know, it's just your opinion and your gut feeling versus my opinion and my gut feeling. So Dr. Joseph Coleman was a sociologist at Johns Hopkins. And 50 years ago, he was talking with American teenagers, and he asked them, among other things, he asked them this question: if all your friends wanted you to join a particular club and one of your parents did not approve, would you still join? And two generations ago, 50 years ago, the majority of American teens told Dr. Coleman, no, they would not join if one of their parents did not approve, because the good regard of their parents mattered more to them than all of their friends. I've asked a similar question. I posed a similar question to kids in many venues across the United States, including in Dallas and Lancaster and Plano. I've done a lot of events in and around the Dallas area. And I've asked kids, if all your friends wanted you to join a particular social media site, would you consult your parents before you join? And the most common answer I get from kids everywhere in the United States is neither yes nor no. The most common answer I get is laughter. They burst out laughing. One kid said to me, my parents have no idea what Ask FM is. They probably think it's some kind of radio station. Why would I ask them? It's a big shift. 50 years ago, kids cared what parents thought. 30 years ago, parents cared what their parents thought. Kids cared what parents thought. Today, American kids care much more what other kids think than what their parents think. They may say they love their parents, but they see their parents more as instrumental, meaning that their parents are useful as providers of money and stuff. Hmm. But the people they really whose opinion they really care about is other peers. The attitude is pretty much summarized in a parenting book in the United States a few years back titled, Get Out of My Life, But First Would You Drive Me and Cheryl to the Mall? that's the American kids' attitude toward their parents, and it's really harmful, because if the opinion of your peers matters more than the opinion of your parents, then kids become anxious, because you got to be checking the latest text message. You've got to make sure you're responding promptly. You don't want any of your the regard of your peers is conditional and contingent on your being what they want you to be. And every kid knows that can change in 5 minutes. You can go from being popular to being nobody in one day. And so kids are anxious. And there's been a 400% explosion in the rate of anxiety among American kids over the last 30 years. And that's part of the reason.
That's such an interesting point, because kids sort of understand, you know, their peers may be a great influence or a bad influence, but they understand that they're only going to be, you know, on the ins, as my father would have said, if they sort of follow the norms of the group, whereas, you know, kids know that their parents are going to love them regardless.
Well, and that's what's so important. And this leads to some of the very concrete suggestions I make to parents based on what I've seen. Cancel the play date. Make a family date instead. I see all these parents who are driving their kids from one friend's house to another friend's house. And the unspoken message there is that time with your friends matters more than time with your family. When you go away on a vacation, don't allow your child to bring their friend with them. The vacation is time for you and your child to have fun time together, not for you to subsidize some expensive play date for them at the beach. And again, so many parents are so confused on this part, and they are running themselves ragged, driving their kids from one activity to a friend's house. And there's no time for a family meal at home. The family meal at home should be a top priority.
Do you have the sense, Leonard, that a lot of parents today think their kids' love is conditional, that if they displease their children won't love them?
I do, and I think that's a huge problem. You know, I've been involved in a handful of cases of sexual assault as in my role as a physician. In one case, my only role was to sit with mom in the conference room at the hospital while her daughter was being examined with a forensic analysis. And I walked in, her underage teenage daughter, I might add, I walked into the room, and the first thing mom said to me was, "I knew I shouldn't have let her go. It was a party at the university, and she's 15 years old. I knew I shouldn't have let her go." And you want to shake mom and say, "Well, then why'd you let her go?" But of course, I didn't do that because I knew why she let her go. She didn't want her daughter to be angry with her. She didn't want her daughter to be displeased with her. Look, one of your jobs as a parent is to keep your child safe. If you're doing that job, you're going to do things that your child may not approve of. But it's your job. And if you don't do that job, bad things can happen.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to John on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, John.
Hi, Chris. How you doing?
Very well, thanks.
I just wanted to see what Dr. Sachs might have to say about the role of step-parents in all this. I was married for 5 years. My stepkids were 8 and 12 when their mother and I got together, and they were 17 and 13 when we got a divorce. Good kids, but one thing that I could not help noticing was they were given choices on just about everything. And I grew up in a family where accountability was pretty much the word of the day. But it really blew me away some days because even though we had signed up my stepkids for the bus, every morning it was, "Hey, do you guys want to ride the bus or do you want your stepdad to drive you?" And invariably they would, no matter, it didn't matter if it was going to make me late for work, they wanted me to drive them. And if I said no, then I was treated like the enemy when I got home. And I never could understand that. And there was really no limit set, no boundaries. And if I tried to set them, then that would cause a rift between me and their mother.
Well, do you have any thoughts about that, Leonard?
Oh, absolutely. And John's making such a good point, which is that nothing works if the two parents don't agree. And this is a challenge in a marriage. It's a challenge in a blended family. It's a huge challenge in the case of divorce. If you don't agree with your partner, don't argue in front of the child. Say, "Hey, honey, would you step over here and let's have a chat?" Talk with your partner out of earshot of your child. And you, as the adult, need to come to an agreement with your partner, the other adult. You have to present a united front, because if you don't, kids will exploit that rift, and it will destroy the marriage because there will be a race on to see which parent will give in more. And kids, even young kids, are really skilled at exploiting that.
Of the three styles of parenting, permissive, authoritative, and authoritarian, you, like every other expert I've ever spoken to, recommend authoritative parenting. What does that look like exactly?
So you've used the formal terms. I prefer the phrase too hard, too soft, and just right. The too soft parent is only concerned about loving the child and may be very good at expressing love, but is not good at enforcing the rules. And those kids, we now know from longitudinal studies, are much more likely as adults to be addicted to drugs and alcohol, to be in poor physical health, to have a whole variety of their own problems. The too hard parent is often using corporal punishment, not communicating love. And those kids, we now know from longitudinal cohort studies, are more likely as adults to be violent, to be convicted of a felony, and not to be able to sustain a romantic relationship. You want to be just right. And when you present it that way, every parent will say, "Oh, yeah, I want to be just right." And most parents will insist that they are just right. But Diana Baumrind, who's really studied this carefully, has found over the last 30 years there's been a real shift in the kind of parenting that American parents actually do. And it's shifting in the permissive direction. And, you know, in every culture, there's a tendency to warn about the dangers to which we are least prone. In a puritanical culture, pastors warn about the dangers of indulgence. In a permissive culture, we have all kinds of people warning about the dangers of being too strict. But that's not really the danger that most American parents are facing. Most American parents are having trouble being just right, having some backbone.
Do social media relationships by the parents have anything to do with this? I think about the sort of, you know, arms race to give your kid the most. And you can always look, you know, online and find another parent who seems to be more permissive than you are, or you know, whose child has received more material benefits than yours has.
Well, and the parents and the kids certainly know about this. And this, again, creates a challenge. So, for example, should your child have a cell phone? You know, how do we know what to do as parents? Well, we think about how our parents did things, and if they did it right, we try and do it that way. But in the case of cell phones, we didn't have cell phones 20, 30 years ago, so that doesn't give you any guidance. So what parents default to is they look to what other parents are doing. And when I speak to parents, I say, don't do that, because other parents don't have a clue either. Your child should not have a cell phone until at least 13 years of age, and most 13-year-olds aren't ready for one either. But the kids, you know, the 10-year-old kids will say, all the other kids in my grade have a cell phone, and indeed many of them do. And the parents are thinking like, well, if all the other kids have one, you know, I don't want my kid to be the odd kid out. And this, again, is where this is a big motivation for writing the book, is to give parents the data, to give parents the studies, so that it's not just their intuition negotiating these very unfamiliar waters. Should my child be on social media? How much should I know about what my kid is doing on social media? Should my child have a cell phone? There's actually good, hard, peer-reviewed studies addressing these questions, and I provide those in the book, and that's what I speak to parents about. But I have to encourage parents to be parents, to empower parents. And if your kid is 11 years old and wants a cell phone, the answer is no. And if she says, well, all the other kids have one, it's too bad. You're not going to have one. Again, many parents are so uncomfortable with that. And I reassure them. Look, so this one parent in New York City told me this story. And another parent in Santa, Utah told me a very similar story. Both these parents did not allow their daughter to have a cell phone. And in both cases, most of the other girls especially had one. And the other girls had no problem with this. It was the other parents who pushed back. The other parents said, don't you think you're depriving your daughter? She's going to be the odd girl out. And in both cases, these parents told me how strange it was that they were getting so much hostile feedback from other parents for not giving in to their kids. I tell parents, if you're going to be successful as a parent in the United States, you're going to have to do things differently from many of your neighbors.
Let's go back to the phones now at 800-933-5372. Bruce is calling from Fort Worth. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I guess you kind of called almost somewhat interested earlier, because I was stating that I think that there has to be like a balance in parenting. I myself grew up in a somewhat strict immigrant household, almost like a tiger mom kind-ish, where it focuses on education and doing well in school, but not being really a critical thinker. So I wasn't really allowed to go out with friends as much or go out and you know, have dates or anything of that nature. And so I think it's good to have kids learn to question authority in good ways, or even letting kids learn to fail and understand the consequences of their actions. I think that's part of being a productive citizen. The balance I see is really about either, you know, being a laissez-faire parent, and also between treating your kid as like a pet. Because I think overall the kids are going to grow up in lives much different than what the parents they grew up in, and so they had to learn themselves to be self-reliant and communicate in different ways.
That's an interesting perspective. What do you think about that, Leonard?
Oh, I absolutely agree. You need to teach kids to question authority, to be critical thinkers, but there is no room for disrespect. It's fine for a child to say, Dad, I don't agree with you. I think you're mistaken here, and here's why I think you're mistaken. That's fine, but it is never acceptable for a child to say, you don't know what the you're talking about. That's not permissible, and yet that's become very common. And again, many parents don't get it. They don't understand the distinction between respectful disagreement on the one hand and the culture of disrespect on the other. I find many Americans who think that their child using bad language to them is showing how creative the child is. And that parent is wrong and is inculcating bad habits. Look, I'm an employee. I work in a workplace. If you start bad-mouthing your supervisor, that's really not a useful skill. That's not the kind of skill you want to be teaching at home. By all means, teach your child critical thinking and respectful disagreement. And I talk about how to do that in the book based on successful parents I've seen. But you need to do it in a respectful way. And that's what a lot of American kids no longer know how to do.
How can we help our children learn to want the right things?
Yeah, I talk about educating desire. And again, so many American parents think it's their job to see that their kid is as happy as possible. And they're confusing pleasure with happiness. So this boy tells his parents his favorite thing to do is to play violent video games. And the parents said, well, you know, maybe that's just who he is. Look, it is your job to educate desire. He's a kid. He's not been exposed to mature adult culture. If you set him loose in American culture, what he's going to get from the culture of Justin Bieber and Miley Cyrus is video games and porn. If you want him to know more than that, you've got to educate him. You've got to expose him to what you think is worthwhile and useful.
We're speaking this hour with Dr. Leonard Sachs. He's a family physician and psychologist. His newest book is called The Collapse of Parenting, How We Hurt Our Kids When We Treat Them Like Grown-Ups. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter. I'm at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with family physician and psychologist Dr. Leonard Sachs about his new book, The Collapse of Parenting, How We Hurt Our Kids When We Treat Them Like Grown-Ups. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. So, Leonard, I am a real stickler with my children about sleep, and that makes me the uncoolest mother west of the Mississippi. But I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the relationship between sleep deprivation, behavioral problems, things that might look like, a cognitive problem or a mental illness that could be solved with better sleep.
Oh, my goodness. That's one that I see so often. So this girl did fine in elementary school. Grades started going down in middle school. Now in high school, she's really struggling, and she's telling her parents that she has trouble concentrating and focusing, and they take her to a board-certified child psychiatrist who says, well, let's try Vyvanse and see if it helps. And after 1 week on Vyvanse, everyone's thrilled. Wow, what a difference, teacher says. She's so sharp. She's so smart. But then the parents got a little concerned because she started having some side effects and palpitations, and they brought her to see me for a second opinion. And I did a careful sleep history with this girl, and she was very forthright. She's in her bedroom with the door closed with a mobile phone. Her parents have no idea what she's doing. They don't want to disturb her privacy. Very 21st century notion there. And so she's texting her friends at 2 a.m. and she's getting 4 or 5 hours of sleep a night. She should be getting 9. She's sleep deprived. Adderall and Vyvanse are the 2 most popular medications for ADD in the United States. What are they? They're amphetamines. They're speed. They compensate for her sleep deprivation. So, yeah, she did a lot better when she's taking amphetamines in the morning, but that doesn't mean she has ADD. The appropriate remedy is for the parent to take the phone at 9 o'clock at night, turn it off, put it in the charger, which stays in the parent's bedroom. She can have it back tomorrow morning. This has to be the parent's call. It's not reasonable to put this burden on your daughter. What's your 14-year-old daughter supposed to say tomorrow in school when her friend says, hey, I texted you at midnight. How come you didn't answer? You're supposed to say, well, researchers at Stanford have found that sleep deprivation increases the risk of depression among adolescents. Come on. You have to allow her to say, hey, my evil parents take my phone every night at 9 and won't let me have it back till the next morning. It's your job to be the evil parent. But many parents don't get this. Look, you should respect your child's physical privacy. You can't go barging in the room at 2 a.m. You have to knock first. But if she's got a mobile phone and you knock, she's going to put it under the pillow. And one parent said to me, Dr. Sachs, are you suggesting my daughter might lie to me? And I said, yes, absolutely. Look, the research shows she's more likely to lie to you than to anyone else because she cares what you think. She cares what you think. She doesn't want to disappoint you. She doesn't want to let you down. You have to be the parent. Mobile phones off at 9 o'clock. Go in the charger. Charger stays in the parent's bedroom.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Daryl is on the line now in Dallas. Hi, Daryl.
Yes, good afternoon. Thanks for this conversation, Dr. Sachs. My question is, and I'm in Dallas now, but I'm from a neighborhood in Maryland, Mitchellville, middle-class African-American neighborhood. Is this culturally, you know, when you're talking, I was thinking about the Chris Rock joke where the white child would tell this black friend, at my house we don't do those things, and you should speak to your parents about it, and so on and so forth. And then even today, as when I walk through malls with my friends, we kind of cringe when we see a child being disobedient. Now, like, I'm 57 years old, and I still cringe at that. Is it something that's culturally, I guess, driven, this type of empowerment? And not just African-Americans, I would think even with, Jamaicans, I guess, would be African-Americans, or Filipinos, or the such.
Okay. It's almost universal, I have found, among people in this country who speak English at home. The big exception in the United States is people who don't speak English at home. So I was talking with a mother and father who emigrated here from Syria, and they normally speak Arabic at home. They're bilingual. They also speak English, but they usually speak Arabic at home. And they were telling me about their son. When he wants to be disrespectful, he will switch to English. And Dad told me it's like Justin Bieber just walked in. Hmm. And his body language changes, and he becomes defiant and insolent and disrespectful, and he can only do this in English. And the son himself will say, you know, I don't even know how to say those things in Arabic. And there's so much research now that kids who are new immigrants to this country and who do not speak English at home are much less likely to be anxious, much less likely to be depressed. It's a huge effect, and it's a new finding. As recently as 30 years ago, it was the other way around. Kids who spoke English at home were less likely to have psychiatric problems compared to new immigrants. But we've seen this huge flip over 30 years' time where being American and speaking English at home is now a major risk factor for anxiety and depression in teens. And that represents, I think, the collapse of American parenting.
Back to the phones now. This time we have Kevin on the line in Arlington. Hi, Kevin.
Hello. How are you doing?
Very well, thanks.
Dr. Sachs, I have a question. I have a 2-year-old right now. I'm Jamaican. His mother is from Trinidad, and I'm trying to teach him all the values that are Caribbean, where no phones until the age of 18, probably. And his mother is up in arms with me about that. You know, it's just Am I being bad or the bad parent here, Dr. Sex? I just hang up and let you answer my question.
Well, I hate to sound shamelessly commercial, especially on an NPR affiliate, but I encourage you to get a copy of my book and give it to her. My book has over 400 scholarly references. And again, that was a big motivation for writing the book, because if you just have one person who says, well, I think kids can have cell phones when they're 10, and another person says, well, I don't think so, how are you supposed to decide? You got two people venting their opinions, but in fact, there's a lot of data, a lot of research that can inform good parenting practice. And if you just say to your wife or partner, well, I'm right and you're wrong, you're not going to get anywhere. But if you hand them a book and say, hey, would you just read chapter 2 in this book and we'll talk about it. And if they will take the time to read one chapter, then they can say, look, I disagree. They can email me and tell me what they don't agree on with a copy to you, and we can have a dialogue. But there is a lot of good data to inform this. And the fact is, a lot of parents in the United States have shifted too far in that permissive zone. Again, Dr. Baumrin, the researcher I'm always citing, says that the best parents are both strict and loving. And for many American parents, that doesn't make sense. Many American parents think you can be strict or you can be loving. They don't see how you can be both. But the best parents are both strict and loving.
What about that gradual sort of, you know, giving them a bit more rope? You know, some people have called in and described it as letting them make mistakes and learn from those mistakes. You know, there are some mistakes that we're willing to let them make, you know, failing a test if they didn't study properly. There are others that can be dangerous. So how do we decide, you know, when to let life teach them a lesson and when to simply prevent them from making a mistake?
Great question. Parenting is an art. It's not a science. You can't plug in the question to Google and get an answer that's of any value, because the answer that's right for you may not be right for the family next door. So if your child's not doing their homework at 14 years of age and not preparing for the test, okay, I think it's reasonable within constraints. Go ahead, let them see what the consequences are that they're not going to do well on that exam. But in other domains, like is my child going to have a cell phone in the bedroom? That's a domain where the child should not have the choice. That's a domain where the parent has to make the choice. It's not reasonable or appropriate to let a 14-year-old decide whether or not they're going to have a mobile phone in their bedroom at nighttime.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email think@kera.org. Let's go next to Victor in Dallas. Hi, Victor.
Hello, how are y'all?
Very well, thanks.
Well, my opinion is that one of the reasons why a lot of children misbehave is because, you know, parents feel guilty because, you know, they're both working. So whenever they, you know, they want something, the children want something, they just want to give it to them no matter what it is. And also I think it's a cultural thing, you know. I'm a Latino, so my mom, I always have respect to my parents and my grandmother. And if my grandmother said, no, you cannot do this, I was not, you know, because she told me not to, whether I like it or not. So I think that's one of the problems. They felt guilty about, you know, working.
What do you think about that, Leonard?
Well, Victor is making a couple points there that I think are important. One is regarding being a Latino and speaking Spanish at home, there's actually this striking research showing that when immigrants come from South America to the United States, if they start speaking English at home, the risk of that child becoming anxious or depressed goes up very significantly. So when I speak to diverse communities, I say, look, if you're speaking a language other than English at home, keep doing it. Because the contemporary American culture that American kids are that English-speaking American kids are part of, again, that culture of Justin Bieber, Kim Kardashian, Miley Cyrus, that's a really toxic culture, and you want to connect them to a different culture that's a healthier culture.
What do you suggest to parents who feel like they need to make some changes, but you know, they're already well down the road? Do you do this cold turkey, or do you go step by step and, you know, introduce a new rule once a week?
You do it cold turkey. You sit down with your kids. Don't try to be cute, and don't try to do it subtly or gradually. Say to your to your kids, look, I've been doing a lot of things wrong, and we're going to make some big changes starting today. There will be no more phones in the bedroom at nighttime. There will be no screens at the supper table. There will be no devices at the supper table. There will be no TV on at the supper table. And this is why. And I know you may not agree, but these are the new rules. And your kids may not approve, and they may push back very hard. And the older the child, the more challenging it's going to be. And you may have a child who says, I hate you, I hate you. You're going to, like, totally ruin my whole life. And you have to stand your ground because that's your job.
What's so special about family dinners? What happens over a meal that couldn't happen at, say, some other kind of quality time, moment?
Well, perhaps it could. But we have the data regarding family meals. So in one study of 28,000 teenagers, they ask kids, okay, in the last 7 days, how many evening meals have you had at home with a parent? 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And then they quantitatively assessed anxiety, depression, life satisfaction, pro-social behavior, and they found with every step from 0 to 1, 1 to 2, 4 to 5, 7, 6 to 7, there was a significant improvement in life satisfaction, in pro-social behavior, a significant decrease in anxiety and depression. And yet, even though we have these data, you look over the last 30 years, the proportion of teenagers having a meal at home with a parent in the last 24 hours has plummeted. Because, again, so many parents are so busy ferrying their kids from school to this activity, to that friend's house, and they're not eating a meal at home. And the unspoken message, the unintended message, is that meal at home, family time, is the lowest priority. And that tremendously undermines your child's well-being.
I know parents who say, I love that idea, but there's not time to prepare a decent meal. Is it okay to get food from elsewhere and bring it home and eat it together? Is it about what we're eating or the fact that we're eating together?
It's about the fact we're eating together. I don't think it makes a bit of difference where the food comes from. What's important is that you are sitting at table with your child and there is nothing else. There's no screens. There's no TV. It's time for you to listen to what your child has to say, time for you to build that art of face-to-face conversation, which is an art. It's a skill. It has to be acquired. And so many kids now are not acquiring that because they're looking at screens all the time.
Dr. Leonard Sachs is a family physician and also a psychologist. His newest book is called The Collapse of Parenting, How We Hurt Our Kids When We Treat Them Like Grown-Ups. Leonard, this has been such an interesting conversation. Thank you very much for making time for us.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Alex Smith. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. You can email the show at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.